If you need help or want to help stop human trafficking, call the hotline now at 1-833-900-1010.
With Open Mouths, the podcast is hosted by Carnita Lilla, Associate Curator, Art of Africa at Agnes Etherington Art Center. She sits down with artists, musicians, curators, and spoken word poets to discuss the expressions of their practice. She finds out how they found their artistic voice, which life events shaped them, and who their inspirations are. Find new episodes on Digital Agnes, CFRC's website, and on your favorite podcasting platform. Subscribe now and join us for moving and inspiring conversations.
Welcome to Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is KM on the FM, and I'm your host for this week's Grad Chat. A show like this could not happen without the support from the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs and CFRC, so a big thank you to both of them. If you've missed the show at any point, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. It's a great way to stay informed about all the exciting research our graduate students and postdocs are getting up to. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Jessica Caravaggio, who is doing a PhD in English under the supervision of Dr. Jane Tolmie. Welcome to Grad Chat, Jessica.
Hi, thank you for having me, Katie.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and I am really looking forward to learning more about your exciting topic. So your research topic is young adult fiction, feminist theory, and fandom studies. Can you tell us a little bit more about your work and what that means in general?
Yeah, so I do work with young adult fiction, very popular young adult fiction texts you've probably heard of, like Twilight by Stephanie Meyer and Court of Thorns and Roses by Sarah J. Maas. That's another very popular, like, romanticy style YA text. But I was trained in feminist theory and feminist literature. So what I do is I kind of look at connections between popular feminist theory and popular YA texts to kind of see what these texts are saying about the role of women, about femininity itself, how they define femininity. And then I kind of look at how those texts are creating and fostering discussions online about social issues, feminist issues for readers in social media communities. So I look specifically at a community called Book Talk on the social media site TikTok. You might have heard of it. And on this site, I found that a lot of readers, users of this site, they use Twilight and ACOTAR and other YA texts to discuss and debate a lot of these feminist issues. And it means that it's a site of a lot of feminist consciousness raising, which is really cool. So not only do I kind of do some more traditional, the field of English style research into these YA texts, but I also go into online communities and I look at how readers are interacting with these texts in these newer reader community spaces.
Oh, that sounds very interesting. And I know those two main texts that you mentioned are extremely popular, and I'm sure have some very opinionated people who discuss them on Book Talk, as I have seen.
Oh, yes. Lots of opinions, which is great for me, right? Lots of opinions means lots of discussion, means lots of material.
That is very fun to be using your research, your kind of academic research skills, to investigate a topic that, you know, many people might be familiar with, but not have spent as much kind of time delving deeply into as you are. So you mentioned it's a space for feminist consciousness raising. What are some of the kind of issues or trends you see in discussions on Book Talk about those two texts that you've mentioned?
Right. So it's interesting because a lot of people will identify Twilight and ACOTAR as having a lot of anti-feminist themes. And I don't disagree with those people at all. I think they're totally correct about that. But I think that texts that have a lot of anti-feminist themes can be really generative in terms of discussion. These are super popular texts that people are already organically interested in, right? They have their eyeballs on, they want to talk about. And so I think these texts are popular in a lot of ways because they appeal to a lot of internalized beliefs that are shaped by patriarchy about what ideal masculinity looks like, about what ideal femininity looks like, about what ideal relationships look like. And when readers kind of discuss and debate topics that might seem silly, like Team Edward or like Team Jacob, you know, which side are you on? A lot of times they're talking about, you know, not whether Robert Pattinson or Taylor Lautner is more attractive, but they're talking about consent violations. They're talking about unequal power dynamics between different characters, right? And this kind of discussion is really valuable to feminist consciousness raising efforts because people are able to talk to each other in open forums about feminist issues, and talking about them through the lens of literature abstracts them. So people are able to approach them with less bias and with less of a personal stake in the results of that discussion. So it's a place where a lot of people are learning new language, like, you know, internalized misogyny, like the phrase benevolent sexism, things like this. They're learning a lot of new language to describe the experiences of characters in the text and therefore to describe their own experiences. And they're also having a lot of really interesting debates and discussions about the actions and behaviors and thoughts of a lot of different people in the text.
Well, that sounds really exciting for a lot of young adult readers who are kind of engaging with these topics, maybe for the first time, and are seeing this apply in their own lives and hopefully are learning a lot
for sure
from these discussions. Do you think scholarly work is keeping up with what young adult fiction and what book talk is up to at this time?
I think that the field of young adult fiction studies is still incredibly new. There's still a lot of space for new research to be done. And that is for a lot of reasons. First of all, YA itself is an incredibly new category of literature, right? A lot of people identify the first YA text as being published sometime between 1948 and 1967. So it's been around for less than 100 years. That's because we haven't really had an understanding of the category of person, you know, teenager or adolescent, for a very long time. And when something is new, it takes a long time to gain legitimacy among academics. This is the same with something like comic studies, for example. Comics have been around for a long, long time, but comic studies as a field really only emerged in like the 80s and the 90s. So YA literature is similar in that way. And then there's also some roadblocks to people studying YA because, you know, scholarly communities are not these perfectly progressive communities where they're immune to being influenced by larger social narratives that say that literature that's specifically for young women, specifically for girls, is like stupid or frivolous or unimportant, you know, because these larger social narratives say that young women and girls themselves are sometimes stupid or frivolous or unimportant. And this makes studying YA fiction really exciting and challenging because, you know, there's not as much of a canon of criticism and theory to draw on, but there's also a lot of space to like explore certain niches that people are really passionate about. So I don't think that research has really kept up with book talk itself, but that's a good and a bad thing for me, I guess. There's very little research that's been done on book talk previously. A lot of that has to do with education and how teachers can utilize book talk as a resource for students in their English classes, not so much on the literary criticism side. So that is something very new.
And did that influence that kind of gap in literary criticism approaching book talk? Did that influence your choice to choose TikTok specifically as a site of research inquiry?
Yeah, definitely it did. Most of what influenced my interest in YA specifically was kind of this gap that I saw in the field of literary criticism more generally, right? When I did my undergraduate degree at the University of Toronto, there were no YA courses available. There were children's literature, there was contemporary fiction, there were historical periods where you could study different literatures, but not YA fiction. You don't see a lot of YA fiction classes still in a lot of high-ranking universities. And this is something that I'd always been interested in, this field of literature. I worked at Indigo for a long time too, so I was able to, you know, talk to a lot of young readers who were really passionate about this field. It's the books that I would read with my friends and talk about with my friends a lot. And so it's something that's always been a big part of my life. What influenced my interest in TikTok specifically and book talk was actually the way that misogyny has kind of exploded on the app in recent years. And I was interested in this contrast between between, you know, misogyny on TikTok at large compared to book talk, where I saw a lot of these, you know, consciousness raising discussions happening. You know, obviously these discussions were not perfect and people had a lot of opinions that I disagreed with, but I think that's how things get done, is people with different opinions talk to each other and a lot of education happens. On TikTok more generally, it's frequently understood correctly as a place where young people are often being radicalized towards right-wing politics, specifically via misogynistic rhetoric that targets very vulnerable communities like trans people and sex workers. And I wanted to investigate consciousness-raising strategies on the same platforms where a lot of this anti-feminist sentiment was so rampant. So to back that up a little bit with some brief stats, just a couple of months ago in March, Amnesty International published an article that released results of an Amnesty International UK poll that was asking young people about where they most often encountered misogynistic content online. And the results were pretty shocking. TikTok kind of came out as a leader, unfortunately, in hosting a lot of misogynistic content. I think the stats were that 80% of young women reported encountering misogynistic content on TikTok, and the next site down from that, Instagram, was not even close with like 61%, right? So
quite a discrepancy, and that's most young women who are using TikTok are experiencing.
Yeah, exactly.
Misogyny.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of this is due to these, you know, mega influencers, people like Andrew Tate, where articles have been written on him by the CBC, by the BBC, by The Guardian, about how he's basically, you know, participated in grooming an entire generation of young men on TikTok to believe that abusing women in all types of ways can be justified. This is the same person who's currently being investigated for human trafficking in one country and, you know, for charges of rape in another country. He is proof that this online misogyny has real world consequences. And a lot of gender-based violence has also been linked back to these, you know, online fear communities, as people call them. This was, I think, reported also by the Canadian Museum of Human Rights in 2023, that a lot of this online misogyny was directly linked to real world gendered violence, like the 2018 Toronto van attack, for example.
And it's very interesting that your work is investigating communities who kind of counter that and create their own spaces for a very different type of dialogue, like a pro-feminist supportive dialogue amongst mostly young women, but I'm sure folks of many different gendered backgrounds. It seems like conversations and trends on BookTok and TikTok in generally are moving at a rapid pace. What is it like researching a topic which involves a really complex and constantly evolving community, such as these creators on BookTok that you are studying?
Right. It's difficult. It presents a lot of challenges because TikTok isn't like a database, right? It isn't. I wasn't trained in my education as a researcher to research social media spaces, right? And because there's not a lot that's been published on BookTok, there's not a lot of previous research on BookTok, I can't even lean on what other people have done to guide my own research. So I'm doing a lot of new things, and those new things are probably not perfect methods at all. But what I'm hoping is that, you know, slowly, as more people are doing research into these spaces, into reader communities on social media spaces, then our understanding of how to do that research better kind of grows and grows and grows. And I'm a part of, you know, doing something imperfectly so people can do it better later on. BookTok is very borderless because TikTok itself is very borderless, right? There are hashtags that categorize videos, but on the whole, there's not a lot of categorization because the space is meant to be a space where content finds you rather than where you find content. So, you know, based on what you like, what you comment on, what you watch all the way through, TikTok will show you what they think you want to see. And in some ways, that actually can help research because my interest was in a very narrow category of videos. It was in videos on Twilight and ACOTAR, Court of Thorns and Roses, that touched on, even if it was in like a joking way, some sort of discussion of these feminist issues that I was concerned with. And so once I started, you know, seeking out those videos, watching them all the way through, searching through comment sections to see what people were saying about these texts and about the topics that these videos were discussing, then TikTok started feeding me more and more of those videos, right? So it was, the research was coming to me rather than me having to go find it. However, you never know what's being left out because the algorithm happened not to be triggered to show it to you. So I also spent a lot of time on, you know, various hashtags, looking through videos that hadn't been directly fed to me. And then the third sort of action that I took was also reaching out directly to content creators to see what their experience was on the app as someone who was creating content and engaging with people directly rather than kind of lurking on the sidelines and watching it all play out. And so that was important to me to know how the experience of the site was different for different types of users and how creators' experiences shaped how they thought of BookTok as a community and of TikTok as a larger social media space.
It sounds like you're blending, well, you're creating new methods, but also blending a lot of interdisciplinary research methods into your project. Is that fair to say?
It is fair to say. I wouldn't say it's that well thought out, but I'm doing my best and hoping that it helps people who study these readerly spaces next, mm-hmm. and they can kind of build off of the work that I've done. I recognize that it's not perfect because it's new and new research never is.
No, that's very exciting, though, to be on the cutting edge of kind of research method development and pairing that with, of course, your background in critical analysis and literary studies. And you mentioned your interviews with BookTok creators. How many folks did you interview and what did those look like?
So I reached out to a bunch of creators and I ended up interviewing four of them. I wanted to reach people of different ages, different backgrounds, and different size communities on the platform, mm-hmm. right? So I ended up talking to two creators who specifically made content about Twilight, not solely on Twilight, but a large portion of their following was interested in these videos, and they'd consistently made videos about Twilight and discussed these feminist issues in their videos. And then I did the same with A Court of Thorns and Roses, right, where I reached out to two creators, one of whom is a man named Connor, and he was recreating in his home basically every single chapter of the book as he was reading and kind of giving his own take while also like reenacting scenes, which was very funny. But he also took a lot of time to, you know, make a lot of sarcastic jokes about the like in-world misogyny that was happening and how it could parallel with things happening in our own world. Really cool to get to sit down with them and talk to them about what brought them to the site, about what brought them to these specific texts. They had a lot of different opinions about, you know, whether BookTok and TikTok separately could be identified as feminist spaces, about what it meant to them to be fostering a community where feminism was an important part of the content that they produced. Yeah, it was a really great experience. Yeah.
Oh, that's really fascinating, because I think TikTok does a great job, for better or worse, democratizing the way that all of us are able to share and connect. So we have these new voices and new creators who maybe in a more traditional media landscape wouldn't have gotten the platform to share their thoughts about these texts and are now able to build their own communities to discuss what they would like to discuss.
Exactly. I think one of the foundational romance theory texts is Janice Radway's Reading the Romance from, I think, 1984 it was published. And it's based on research that she did into communities of women reading romance novels. And she says at the beginning of her book, you know, this is kind of difficult research to do because women don't want to talk about the fact that they read romance. And often, like, they're very segregated into, you know, their own domestic spaces. And they don't want, it's a very private thing. They don't want to talk about it with other people because it's linked directly to their sexuality. Mm. But with the advent of, like, BookTok and even similar spaces on other social media apps like Bookstagram, for example, or there's lots of book creators, BookTube, I think is what they call it on YouTube, right? These are earlier examples where this kind of reading is really brought into public spaces rather than private ones, where people want to talk about their reading and their romance reading and their YA reading really openly and with a lot of different kinds of people. And so that's really exciting for reader habits to change so much that research is then able to change so much as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and it sounds, again, I think you're right on the cutting edge of this. So it's just so exciting to hear about your project and how it's developing and how you are trying to keep up with this constantly evolving community, or communities, I should say.
Thank you. Yeah, definitely. It's a difficult beast to tackle.
Mm-hmm. And I guess, how do you draw scope or try and draw a line about around your PhD studies? As we all know, research can be endless, but, you know, we have to produce a dissertation or finalize a project. So how do you draw a line around what you will include for your dissertation as a project and kind of your broader research agenda?
Yeah, I think avoiding tangents is a problem for every single PhD student that I know. And there's just so many different avenues to go down in terms of this research. And I'm trying not to do too much rewriting and reworking just for practicality's sake. But the way that I've tried to focus it is to kind of bring it back specifically to the text, which is what I've kind of been trained to do, is to link everything back to these texts, which are, unlike book talk, things that are not going to change, things that are, remain rigid in certain ways, and to kind of link everything back to that. And my first two chapters, which don't concern book talk, do this very strongly so that I don't go too crazy with the book talk stuff at the end of the dissertation. So my first two chapters are, you know, looking very closely into how Twilight and Akatar construct different images of femininity and how they represent sexuality and romance in the texts. And by doing that first, what I was able to do is then kind of focus my interest in book talk very specifically on those kinds of issues and how what people are talking about these specific topics. And so it was an exercise of creating a strong foundation for having a very specific focus and sticking to that focus on those topics.
No, that sounds like a good plan, because it sounds like there's so many opportunities, like you said, for tangents. And as fun as that may be, it is important also to finish, right? So,
It's pretty important to finish.
So I'm glad you've got some clear parameters there to keep you grounded. I would like to ask, what are you reading for fun outside of your research? It sounds like you've been doing lots of reading of different texts and reading different types of media, but what do you read for fun right now?
What do I read for fun right now? So I've got a part-time job that enables me to read a lot of children's fiction, actually. I work with developing lesson content for a tutoring company that does reading and writing and English language learning with young people. And so I read and select a lot of texts for them to read, which has been so much fun. So I kind of keep up with what a lot of kids are reading right now. I read Wild Robot last year and like A Wolf Called Wander. And it's similar enough to YA stuff that it's something I really enjoy, but doesn't kind of infringe upon my own research. So that's fun. And I also have a book club with my friends back home in the GTA. And we do a lot of contemporary fiction. And so we are starting off this month. I think we have a meeting coming up in June, and we've got we're reading Sally Rooney's Intermezzo, her latest book. And I've read all three of Sally Rooney's previous books, so I'm super excited to start this one. We just finished last month with a children's novel called The Eyes and the Impossible by Dave Eggers. It won the Newbery Medal in 2023, and it's this really, really cute story about a dog named Johannes who lives in a park and is kind of concerned with like the equilibrium and the balance of the park itself. So it's like environmental children's literature that is not anthropocentric. It's really focused on like the lives of animals and how they're impacted by the humans who come to visit this park. So it was really cool. Love children's literature, obviously. And I'm a big fan of Sally Rooney too, so I'm excited to get started on that this month. I also really enjoy picking up classics that I feel like I missed out on in my English education. So I recently read The Woman in White by Wilkie Collins. It's like one of the first mystery novels ever written, and I think mystery novels are just so much fun.
Me too. Well, it sounds like you've got a really diverse group of texts that surround your life outside of the PhD.
Oh yeah, for sure. I think that's kind of key to keeping a love of literature alive when you're doing this kind of work. Otherwise, you can get really bogged down in what you're reading and start to see reading as a chore. And that makes it difficult to be inspired to continue working with the texts that you love.
No, I think that's a really good point. It's you've got reading for research and work, but you've also got reading as a hobby and as mm-hmm. a recreation. And I do hear that you are a bit of a serial hobbyist. could you tell us a little bit about what hobbies you're currently enjoying outside of reading for fun?
Oh, yeah. I do a lot to keep myself busy. I've been very into nail art. Mm. So right now I've got some purple chrome nails with some silver accents that I did last week.
Tell our listeners that they are beautiful.
Thank you. And I've been into a lot of different stuff. Last summer I did some like embroidery on some jeans, and I kind of learned how to do like embroidery of different patterns. Just as a fun thing to do while I was watching TV. I got into knitting a few years ago because my best friend is a knitter and she taught me how to knit. And then I did some scarf projects. I did some hand warmers and a little shawl that I got from an Outlander pattern website.
So still related to books.
Books. Yeah, it all comes back to that. And my brother and my sister-in-law bought me a calligraphy set for Christmas a couple years ago. So I was practicing doing some calligraphy. So I really like learning, which shouldn't be a surprise, I guess. I really like learning. Not everything sticks. And sometimes what's most fun for me is to kind of feel like I've conquered a new task and learned how to do it. And then I lose interest a little bit. The nails have stuck around.
And do you get any of your inspiration for some of these hobbies on TikTok as well? And are there other communities that support those hobbies?
Oh, yeah, online? For sure. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I often am very inspired by other women on TikTok who are doing really exciting things in their own niche fields and with their own interests. And it feels like a fun way to kind of participate in that. I think part of what inspired me to do the kind of research that I'm doing in the first place is because I value my female friends a lot. I'm a big sister and I love my little sister so mm-hmm. much. And I just feel like hopefully part of what I'm doing in highlighting young adult literature and in highlighting the voices of young women who are really passionate about this literature is being a champion for them, you know, mm-hmm. saying, you know, these are not like passive fans of this thing. They are engaged, they are political, and they should be listened to. And so, yeah, I think young women doing all sorts of things on TikTok is inspiring and joyful. And I see my work as being connected to that in some way. That makes me really happy.
Mm. Oh, well, thank you, Jessica. I think that is an excellent place to leave it, coming kind of full circle to why you were inspired by for your project in the first place. So thank you so much for coming in today. And it's been great chatting with you. And best of luck with your research. I can't wait to see how it turns out and hopefully get to read the dissertation once it's all completed.
Thank you. And thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
Oh, great. And that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat comes to an end. Don't forget that you can download the show tomorrow, either from iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or CFRC Podcast. Just search for Grad Chat. And until next week, this is KM on the FM.
Completely honest now, okay? Homelessness makes me uncomfortable. But then I think, at least it's not sleeping on the sidewalk with everything I own uncomfortable.
Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness. Thank you.
Join CFRC on September 28th at the Broom Factory at 9:30 a.m. for our Airwave YGK Sound Tech Workshop. Rob Bailey of Kingston Soundworks will facilitate this hands-on workshop for young emerging musicians just starting out playing gigs. Come learn soundboard tech, terminology, troubleshooting, communications, equipment setup, and sound check basics with this local industry pro. Register now for the free workshop, make in-person connections with local musicians at a prestigious venue, and learn the ropes of sound mixing to help you get started with your live stage performances. The fun starts at 9:30 a.m. on September 28th at Broom Factory and includes a catered lunch from our friends at Old Farm Fine Foods. Register now via cfrc.ca. This CFRC Airwave YGK workshop is made possible through the support of the City of Kingston, Kingston Arts Council, the Kingston Music Office, the Broom Factory, and our friends at Kingston Soundworks.
Today from the Wings Archive.
We are now at the stage where we had hope to be 24 hours ago.
It was Saturday night in the UN General Assembly Hall. The President of the General Assembly, Theo Ben-Gurirab, was bringing the negotiations to a close on Beijing Plus Five.
Hours of round-the-clock negotiations finally paid off, and we have just adopted a document to move the global agenda for the advancement of women beyond 1995.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world. Produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Wings producer Frieda Worden was at the Beijing Plus Five conference in New York in June 2000. I'm Nafisa Hoodboy. I asked her, why was it so difficult for the UN to come up with an outcomes document?
The chief issues of contention were globalization and allocation of resources. But sexual rights, which had been adopted at the European Preparatory Conference, was very hotly contested. The fact is that the original Beijing Platform for Action was a consensus document on which there was not full consensus. When it was adopted, most countries announced a list of objections about parts of the platform with which they did not really agree. Those same objections were brought to bear on this document, which was a review of what kinds of progress had been made for women since 1995. Of course, one area of contention was abortion.
The United States, under the Clinton administration, came out strongly for continued support of abortion.
The United States fully supports the call in the Platform for Action for Governments to recognize and address the health impact of unsafe abortions. We regret that little progress has been made. Since Beijing, nearly 400,000 women have died unnecessarily from unsafe abortion. Even where abortion is legal, under certain circumstances, too many countries have not yet trained and equipped healthcare providers, nor have they taken other measures to ensure that abortions are safe and accessible, or to safeguard women's health.
Nicaragua was speaking for the Catholic community, mainly in the developing world, when it opposed abortion.
Nicaragua acknowledges the right to life from the moment of conception until its natural end, which is why provoked abortion or pregnancy interruption cannot be conceived of as a method of family planning or fertility regulation. As specified in the Cairo conference, any legislation governing this issue is the sovereign business of the Nicaraguan nation.
The right wing, which had been lobbying for their agenda, starting with the PrepCom in March, was recorded in this radio program.
We are talking about the Beijing Plus Five conference, a follow-up to the Beijing conference. Lots of radical feminist ideas being implemented. Again, our guests, Kathy Adams from Texas Eagle Forum, Janice Shaw Krause, the Beverly LaHaye Institute.
One of the things that was very disturbing to me is that this PrepCom was only supposed to evaluate how the Platform for Action from Beijing in 1995 has been implemented.
Janice Shaw Krause.
But what they really tried to do was to change the language in things like reproductive rights, so that if they could get that language in there, then they can identify reproductive rights along with universal human rights and say that every woman on earth has the right to control her reproduction.
A sociologist, Jacqueline Skiles, from a non-governmental organization, had also been lobbying at the PrepCom in March. She told Wings how difficult it had been for delegates to arrive at the outcomes document.
It almost seems like a miracle that they finally did agree on a document today. Starting back in March with the preparatory committee for this meeting, it was even more intense and crazy then. Women from non-governmental organizations were caucusing on issues with the delegates who already had a draft document. And we would run around and state our points of view and tug on coattails to try to get them represented in the drafting of the proposed outcome document for this meeting.
I asked Frieda what she saw as the most divisive issue in the entire conference between the North and South.
The issue that caused the most difficulty in negotiations was sexual rights. There's one paragraph in the Beijing platform, paragraph 96, that says women have the right to control their own sexuality. The fundamentalists, both Christian and Islamic, were absolutely livid about this, and they really tried to roll back that language through statements in this outcome document. I was at a workshop on sexual rights, and this is what a delegate told me.
There was a sentence that said in some countries laws have been implemented to address discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. And the country statement that remains in my mind the most was the country that said, first of all, we don't think this is an achievement. Secondly, we don't understand what this has to do with women's human rights. And third, we don't see that this has anything to do with the platform for action. And I think that that kind of sums up the whole variety of reviling statements that were made.
Nicaragua was one of the G77 nations which was vocal against sexual rights, including sexual orientation.
Nicaragua does not recognize the terms sexual rights nor sexual orientation, the definition of which we do not know and has not been established at international fora or conferences.
The European Union clearly supported sexual rights.
Mr. President, I should like to make a statement on behalf of the European Union and also of Bulgaria, the Czech Republic, Lithuania, Romania, and Turkey. The European Union is committed by Article 13 of the Amsterdam Treaty to combat discrimination on the basis of sex, race or ethnic origin, religion or belief, disability, age or sexual orientation. Though the document just approved contains a number of crucial issues for gender equality, we were disappointed that the document contains no explicit reference to the sexual rights of women. We hope that sexual rights will very soon become standard terminology in the United Nations. And we also regret that it wasn't possible to utilize in this final outcome document the language agreed last year at the special session on Cairo Plus 5 with regard to abortion issues.
Discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation is a violation of human rights. This principle is established in Canadian law.
Canada lobbied strongly in favor of introducing sexual orientation as part of the language in the outcomes document at Beijing Plus 5.
We would note that we have made no gains from Beijing on the inherent right of the person to make decisions about her sexual and reproductive life. Paragraph 2 bis recognizes the discrimination that women may experience and underlines the responsibilities of government and the international community to take the necessary steps to prevent and or remedy such discrimination. However, we note that the paragraph makes no specific reference to sexual orientation. Canada considers that the matter of sexual orientation is encompassed in the reference to other status in paragraph 2 bis.
The right wing was aghast at the Western world's support for women's sexual rights.
Who is pushing this? Mark had mentioned that the United States and Canada, the EU, and those three I had known before were pushing this radical agenda, but Australia and New Zealand, did you find that at this PrepCom?
Yes, but there were people working with them, and they were vacillating somewhat.
New Zealand is one of a growing number of countries to prohibit, through legal measures, discrimination on the grounds of sexual orientation.
The New Zealand delegate at Beijing Plus Five.
While this meeting has discussed sexual orientation and not included it in the document, New Zealand interprets other status in the introduction to the final outcome statement at 2bis as consistent with its Human Rights Act 1993 to include marital status, ethical belief, colour, national origin, political opinion, employment status, and sexual orientation. New Zealand looks to the sexual orientation becoming consistent with the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights by the time we meet again to review at Beijing Plus 10.
The Holy See frowned on what it saw as the attempts of some delegations to sneak in new language on women's sexuality.
My delegation is gravely concerned with the persistent attempts by some delegations to introduce new and undefined terms, including sexual rights and sexual orientation, which can be interpreted to include pedophilia, among other things. These attempts demonstrated a blatant disregard of the General Assembly resolution and consistently obstructed and delayed the entire review process.
The right-wing women from non-governmental organizations in the US and Canada had turned out in full force to put pressure on the Beijing negotiations for the outcomes document.
We all wore buttons that were red in the background and said motherhood, the one simple word. And you would think that that would be something that was very innocuous and non-offensive, that people would say, oh, how nice. But it really made the hardcore left wing angry. They did not like the fact that we were introducing that word as something desirable and admirable and something that we applauded.
Goodness.
It was amazing to see the reactions and how angry they became.
I just want to say that I wish the people over at the UN who have been wearing those buttons that say motherhood could hear your story.
This was at a forum supporting sexual rights at Beijing Plus Five.
Because you know so much more about motherhood than me, and I really want to applaud you.
I'm an Iranian, and the mere reason of me being in this country is my daughter, because I took her out to save her life. And the reason for her persecution would be her sexual orientation. And she was a few times arrested because of the way she walked in the street. A child of 15 or 16 years old. You know.
I think what you're saying affirms what we said in the beginning, which is that the issue of sexualities is not only an issue of lesbianism or sexual orientation, it's an issue of how our sexualities are shaped by society and the fear, particularly of women, taking any kind of affirmation and self-direction. So I think your point is really helpful.
The type of harassment described by the Iranian woman was put in perspective after Iran's delegate made reservations to outlaw discrimination in sexual rights.
I would like to dissociate my delegation from any provision in the text, particularly paragraph 8 and 107G ter, that may encourage explicitly or otherwise sexual relations outside the framework of marriage and the family as defined exclusively as the legitimate union between man and women. The Islamic Republic of Iran upholds the principle that safe and responsible sexual relationship between men and women can only be legitimized within the framework of marriage.
The entire Arab bloc had been making the same reservations to the outcomes document, quoting religion, tradition, customs, and constitution. This is what Iraq said.
Mr. President, my delegation demonstrated maximum flexibility in order to reach a balanced and an agreed upon document. However, we have reservations on what may be interpreted in same document, meaning any provisions that may run counter with the Islamic Sharia and its provisions, as well as the tenets of the Islamic religion and the Arab values and traditions.
Frida, my impression is that the Islamic bloc was pretty united in its opposition to women's sexual rights. But you mentioned that there was a lot of division on this issue among the G77.
Yes, the G77, the bloc of the world's poorest countries, were all supposed to be arriving at a common position for negotiating purposes. Those with an Islamic or Catholic ideology tended to oppose sexual rights. However, South Africa in particular was very strongly in favor of sexual rights, and they have a major influence in the G77.
The South African delegation came with a mandate and vision to take Beijing 95 into the new millennium. All human rights of all citizens in South Africa are protected and promoted by a constitution and Bill of Rights. Our constitution informed our approach to this process on the basis of choice to issues such as sexual orientation, reproductive rights, and abortion. Mr. President, we note those areas of regression on the Beijing language.
You are listening to Wing's coverage of the five-year review of the United Nations Beijing Platform for Action, adopted in 1995 to promote women's rights. By the year 2000, conflict over some issues had surged.
South Africa sided with the third world countries grouped as G77 to criticize the effect of globalization and the external debt on women.
We commend this body for having grappled with new challenges such as globalization in a manner that assists member states to address the negative impact of globalization.
The Beijing Plus Five Outcomes document reached consensus that women worldwide had grown poorer since the last conference in 1995 and linked this directly to globalization and the increasing external debt. This is what Suriname said on behalf of the Caribbean states.
Mr. President, the delegations of the member states of the Caribbean community, 14 of which are members of the United Nations, have gathered here in New York, some at tremendous expense and as a demonstration of our commitment to support and advance the Beijing Platform for Action. While a tremendous amount of follow-up activities has occurred within our sub-region, many new challenges have presented obstacles to achieving all of the goals that we set for ourselves in 1995. For our country's structural adjustment programs, globalization, and high external debt have been tremendous constraints in implementing the platform for action. The loss of preferential arrangements, debt servicing, and limited capacity to overcome the burden of unemployment have had enormous consequences and have increased the number of poor women in many of our countries.
The United States disassociates itself from the paragraphs in the outcome document currently numbered 29, 30-tay, and 125-C, dealing with globalization and economic issues.
The U.S. spokesperson at Beijing Plus Five.
These paragraphs characterize globalization and debt as significant obstacles to achieving gender equality. It is our view that national governments bear the primary responsibility for social and economic development and for ensuring equality for women in all walks of life. Most aspects of equality for women have no direct link to international economic and financial issues.
Nigeria spoke on behalf of the G77 and China when it appealed to the developed countries to promote gender equality by increasing assistance programs for women and children.
Mr. President, the statements by the leaders of respective delegations of member states of the G77 at the plenary send our one clear and loud message, and this is that for the countries of the developing nations, the issue of political will and commitments to goal of gender equality is beyond doubt. It is now left for the international community the developed countries and the multilateral financial institutions to demonstrate their commitment to genuine cooperation with the developing countries in the areas of advancement of women. In this connection, I'm renewing the call on developed countries to support in concrete terms through financial resources the efforts of developing countries in the implementation of policies for sustained economic growth and development.
The United States reiterates that with respect to all references to foreign assistance and official development assistance, it is not one of the countries that have accepted an agreed target for such assistance or have made commitments to fulfill any targets.
The U.S. also disassociated itself from the paragraph calling for disarmament.
The record should also show that the United States disassociates itself from paragraph currently numbered 133M-bis, which concerns disarmament. The United States has two concerns with this paragraph. First, the United States disagrees with the paragraph's assertion that the United Nations establishes priorities for disarmament. We believe that establishing priorities for disarmament is the prerogative of member states of the United Nations. Second, the paragraph proposes that resources made available as a result of disarmament activities be allocated to social programs which benefit women and girls. While the United States strongly supports economic and social development programs, especially those that promote gender equality, the United States also has a long-standing position of not linking the two distinct issues of disarmament and the predetermined use of resources realized, if any, from disarmament.
Cuba came out strongly in favor of the G77 countries in its position against the United States.
The delegation of Cuba supports the points made by the distinguished delegation of Nigeria, who represented the G77 and China. Mr. President, we should like to place on record that in the negotiating process that led to the document we are today adopting, there were very difficult and trying circumstances, certain irregularities cropping up in the process. My delegation would like to have this statement become part of the final record of this session.
Sociologist Jacqueline Skiles told Wings that she had found that geopolitical blocs used fora like the Beijing Plus Five conferences to fight other political and economic battles.
We always have those who just hate the United States generally and will oppose anything the U.S. stands for or is in favor of. But then you have the feeling of domination of the South now in the world, the poor countries, by the northern countries. They feel like our countries aren't willing to give their women a chance by being more generous through our corporations and the Bretton Woods economic institutions that we have dominated in terms of debt forgiveness. So there's that kind of larger economic battle being fought.
The right-wing women tried to mobilize support for their agenda by accusing the United Nations of using the Beijing Platform for Action to impose sanctions against developing countries.
Come and join our conversation, 1-800-351-1212. Are you concerned about the feminist agenda? Are you concerned about access to abortion being pushed on people all over the world, including nations whose religion actually stands against abortion? Are you concerned about the definition of violence against women being stretched out to a woman not being able to fulfill her artistic needs and desires? Are you concerned about the definition of the family changing to any group living together? All these things are on the table today. Again, our number is 1-800-351-1212. And Janice, when we talk about reproductive rights, we're talking about something that, first of all, isn't really a right because it's giving young girls, as you mentioned, and people the idea that they have the right to have any kind of sexual activity that they want and then do away with the product of that. Isn't it?
That's exactly right. And part of their emphasis on reproductive rights is if they can get this into the documents as language, then they can start promoting it as something that is binding on countries. I don't know if your listeners are aware that there are many developing countries that are very dependent on funds from the UN for clean water, for supplies for their clinics, for roads, for construction of buildings, and community development. All of those things are helped with UN funds. And unless they cooperate with the policies of the UN, they are subtly kept away from these development projects.
The U.S. delegate made it clear that the Beijing Platform for Action was not legally binding on member states.
The United States understands that, as with the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action, any commitments referred to in the outcome document for further actions and initiatives to implement the Beijing Declaration and Platform for Action attributed to states are, unless such states indicate to the contrary, not legally binding. And they consist of recommendations concerning how states can and should promote the objectives of the conference.
This is even an American issue. Our president has signed into law the Violence Against Women Act. And so we have a federal government that has picked this up either from the UN or the UN from our federal government. And it's creating a travesty in our own laws in this country and pitting men against women instead of us working together in our homes as we have traditionally.
Janice, there's an illustration, of course, of how the Beijing ideas, the things that are pushed, especially by the Western countries, move down through the system into the laws of sovereign nations, isn't it?
Frida, I'm surprised to hear U.S. women criticize the Violence Against Women Act. Was this typical of the right-wing lobbyists at Beijing Plus Five?
Yes. I heard a speaker from the Concerned Women for America's think tank saying that although violence against women is terrible, the solution is to strengthen religion and the family. Another woman who was wearing Islamic dress told me that it was wrong for the Beijing platform to condemn marital rape, because that only encouraged women to rebel against their husbands. She also said that such problems should be handled by religious leaders. Both Christian and Islamic fundamentalists strongly supported the Catholic Holy See, whose quasi-state-like membership in the UN has been challenged by feminists. But, curiously enough, the Church did not support the fundamentalist position on violence.
Mr. President, the Holy See takes note of the progress that has been made in these past few months in the preparatory process for the special session, and cannot but praise the efforts of the international community to advance the condition of women in the world. In this regard, the delegation is pleased with many of the document's provisions, in particular, those condemning all forms of violence against women, those upholding women's rights to economic and political empowerment, and those which outline measures to eliminate poverty and to provide all women with access to basic social services.
You were listening to the delegates to the UN's 23rd special session of the General Assembly on Beijing Plus Five and to NGO delegates representing right and left. The conference was addressed by 178 member states and had input of over 5,000 NGOs. The outcomes document did not allow for any new language on sexual orientation, and there were continuing reservations made on women's sexual rights. On the other hand, despite the opposition from the United States, there was a paragraph criticizing the impact of globalization and the external debt on women and calling for disarmament.
We can all congratulate ourselves for a job well done.
This is how the President of the General Assembly summed up the Beijing Plus Five conference.
There was no backward movement on any of the Beijing language and commitments. Indeed, the text we have just adopted updates the Beijing platform, further strengthening the document in the areas of violence against women, trafficking in women, health, including the right to sexual and reproductive health, education, human rights, poverty, debt relief, and globalization, armed conflict, sovereignty, land and inheritance rights for women, political participation and decision making. If governments demonstrate the necessary political will and allocate the human and financial resources required, I am convinced that the goals of gender equality, development and peace will become a reality very early in the 21st century.
This program was made with assistance from the United Nations Audio Archives, Lisa Rudman, Women's Desk Coordinator of the National Radio Project, Mary O'Grady, and Frieda Worden. I'm Nafisa Hoodboy for Wings.
For more about Wings, check our website, www.wings.org. Wings thanks our supporters, including Genevieve Vaughn, author of the book Forgiving, A Feminist Criticism of Exchange. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
As summer winds down, KPP Concerts is keeping it hot this fall with a stacked lineup of great concerts at the Broom Factory this September. On September 12th, check out Mountainhead, and then Colorado on September 14th, and Punk Icons Propaganda on September 15th. Don't miss Hamilton's The Dirty Nil on September 19th, followed by The Brokes tribute to The Strokes on September 20th. And then on September 26th, check out Petit Beliveau and Neofolk Icons Bridge City Sinners on September 27th. The month ends with Yukon Blonde the night of September 28th at Broom Factory. All shows are co-sponsored by us here at CFRC 101.9 FM, and for a complete list of shows and ticket information, visit kppconcerts.com.